Valmir Insurance provides a range of coverage options, from home and auto insurance to farm and ranch coverage. You can reach Valmir Insurance in Chico at 342-6421 and in Oroville at 533-3424 or at chicoinsurance.com. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KZFR 90.1. This is FM radio, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And the opinions voiced on this program don't necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. Who we're going to interview tonight is Jack Kammer. He lives in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's a men's rights activist. And his books include Goodwill Towards Men. And that was a book where he collected interviews with women, including me, who are feminists, talking about kind of male-female relationships. And his second book was If Men Have All the Power, Why Do Women Make the Rules? And then he did a third book for young men, and it's based on a fable about an island where the girls and women live on one side and the boys and men live on the other side, and then they get together. So the men's movement is really important to me because we need to have equality for both genders, or all the genders, depending on your point of view. And the men's movement kind of spun off from the women's movement, and it looked at ways that social conditioning harms men, like men die earlier than women, they commit suicide more than women, they have health issues because they're not as likely to seek medical help. So the men's movement wanted to look at the ways that our socialization harms men. And then there are different branches of the men's movement. A really strong branch is men who fight for joint custody after divorce. There's a lot of hurt about being excluded and feeling that women get preference in court situations in terms of custody. Kentucky's one of the few states that really suggests that there be joint legal and physical custody. Interesting that it would be Kentucky. And then there's a mythopoetic branch of the men's movement, and they believe that men need to spend time with other men to get into their deep feelings and their male friendships, kind of reform father-son relationships with other men that didn't happen in their family of origin. And these are men you may have heard of who meet in the Mendocino woods and make drum circles and howl at the moon and dance samba and listen to people like Robert Bly and James Hillsman. So there's also a pro-feminist branch. It was called National Organization of Men Against Sexism that I was involved with for a while, and that's how I met a lot of these men. Jack Kammer calls himself a counter-feminist because he feels like men's issues, the ways men are hurt, get disregarded. And he and Warren Farrell use a concept of the lace curtain. And Jack says it's, and Warren says that it's really hard for them to get published and invited to speak if they ask that we consider men's, the ways that men are harmed and how we can help men. So I'm really having my consciousness stretched by interviewing men. I'm working on a book about men's attitudes towards male-female relationships, and I'm finishing up a book about how to have a long, happy marriage. And again, I invite you to email me, gkimble@csuchico.edu, if you have topics that you'd like me to explore with you. Just want to tell you that next month, June, I think it's June 8th. No, it's the 10th, I think. It's the second Thursday of the month. We're having a Maidu elder who's going to talk about the indigenous traditions that kept the environment really healthy. So she's really knows a lot, and we can learn a lot from her. So let us proceed with Jack Kammer. If I can get the mouse. Thank you. So you're listening to KZFR. Stay tuned for interview with Jack Kammer from Baltimore. We think we're going to hear Jack Kammer.
Yes, we will hear.
He is an interesting person. He just got, not just recently, but he got married when he was 60 for the first time. He was raised in a family with five siblings, a doctor, father.
So, Jack Kammer, thank you for talking with me today. Let's start at the very beginning. Where and when were you born?
Well, I was born at a very early age. I was born in Baltimore, Maryland.
What month? I'm interested in your astrological sign.
My dear beleaguered city. So you're into that? Okay, I am the typical Gemini. I am the prototypical Gemini. June 11th.
I'm June 12th.
No way. Really? What does that say? I don't know. Interesting. So you're a Gemini too.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And pretty typical in that lots of different interests, get bored easily.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we're sort of communicators, right? Isn't that one of the things we are typically?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, So do you believe in astrology?
I think it works, and I think it's symbolic, and I don't know how it works. I don't know how a constellation affects a behavior pattern, but I think it's kind of a map for the karma that we bring in from previous existence. So if I to get esoteric on you, but it works.
So, I mean, I understand and appreciate your interest in mysticism and things that we don't even have a clue of the real truth of. You know, our understanding of the universe is we're still very primitive, species. We're just sort of waking up.
Well, 95% of the universe is dark energy and dark matter, and we don't understand that. Most of our DNA is called junk DNA. We don't understand that. Quantum mechanics, quantum physics is weird and spooky, according to the physicists. But it's about a set of laws in the invisible world. So, yeah, I'm doing a webinar on a series of books that I did about mysteries of reality, mysteries of knowledge beyond our senses, mysteries of healing with really visionary scientists on May 15th, if anybody's interested in this topic. So you were born in Baltimore, and then what about your education career path?
Well, let's see. I went to Shenley Road Nursery School. And the story there is that I was in a baby contest. And I won second place, but the bad news is that my mother was the judge. That's a joke. But I think I was in a baby contest, and I think I won second place. I don't know. Shenley Road Nursery School. I went to Roland Park Public School for kindergarten. That was a nice experience. I rode the public bus. I was a kindergarten kid, and I rode the public bus back and forth. No. Home from, I think my mother dropped me off at school, but she and my father worked together. He was a doctor. She was a nurse. She helped out in the office, running the front office and also doing some injections, I guess, once in a while. She had to work, and when kindergarten was over, the best way for me to get home was to ride the bus. And I do remember, as a little boy, she put me on the bus a couple of times. I think we probably had two dry runs, maybe three, maybe only one, but she put me on the bus, and she followed behind the bus to make sure that I got off at the right stop. And so I was a big boy because I could do that. That was nursery school. I went to a Catholic parochial school for elementary school, the Cathedral School of Mary Our Queen. At least that's what it was named from the fourth grade on. Before that, it was a version of that school, but downtown Baltimore. Then I went to Baltimore Polytechnic High School, Baltimore Polytechnic Institute for high school, sort of a math, science, and engineering school, which at the time was only for boys, is now very much gender integrated now. And the girls are doing really well. And then I went to college, thought I wanted to be in journalism. But as soon as I got there, not because of me, it wasn't, you know, because it wasn't after this, there, then that. It was just a coincidence, but I got there and the school lost its accreditation. So, so I sort of stopped trying to be a journalism major and then went to Georgetown Law School for a year till I decided I hated it. Took a year off, went to Arizona and taught seventh and eighth grade. Math, science, and social studies in a little parochial school out there. I had to tell the priest because he wanted me to teach religion. I said, Father, I really can't because I'm kind of like a fourth degree agnostic. You know, I really can't. He said, that's all right. Don't worry about it. So math, science, and social studies. A lot of fun with those seventh and eighth graders because I was only, you know, just, what, 10 years older than them at the time. That was great. Went back to Georgetown Law School to see if I liked it any better, and it turned out I liked it worse. So I said, bye-bye. The reason I thought I might want to go back was because during that summer after I taught school in Arizona, I worked for the Arizona Civil Liberties Union to investigate the Flagstaff, Arizona Municipal Court, which had some very questionable constitutional and due process practices. And I investigated them, wrote a report. That was fun. I was sort of a spy on the court. And that was fun. So I thought maybe I do like this law stuff. Went back to school at Georgetown and took one of the courses I took was environmental law. And I just remember being really, I don't know, disillusioned when the course on environmental law was about how to get around the environmental laws. That's what I took from it. You know, and I just said, I don't really want to do this. I don't find it that interesting. So there you go. And then I've been sort of like a tumbleweed across the desert ever since. You know, and I don't really have a career of anything to speak of.
Well, you have a social work degree and you've worked as a social worker and in correctional institutions working with men, right?
A year in the jail, a year in parole and probation, a year at the National Fatherhood Initiative. But I didn't go to social work school until 2005 when I was 54. Most of my paid income has been through either PR, marketing, advertising, or IT.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a career in the sense of a continually, what do they say in the Help Wanted ads, you know, progressively increasing responsibilities. You know, that's sort of what a career is. Mm. And I don't have that.
Well, you're a Gemini. We understand. Yeah. But a theme that's been very consistent is your concern about gender and feeling that men have gotten not gotten a fair shake. So what led to your interest in men's roles?
So I can trace that to a couple of places. I can trace it back to my first conscious awareness, or I can trace it back to what you might call sort of recovered memories, things that happened a long time ago that I didn't really think about, but they were sort of in there. How far back do you want me to go?
Whatever seems most pertinent.
Well, I mean, if we have time, I'll give you the whole thing.
We've got an hour.
All right. So the first conscious memory I have was when I was on a co-ed softball team in the early 1980s. And we played on Tuesday nights. And after our games on Tuesday nights, we'd go out drinking and dancing and partying and having a good time. And, you know, having some dinner maybe. But couldn't have too much dinner because, you know, that would ruin your appetite for beer. So we would go out and have a good time. So two weeks in a row, I remember this happened. I was sitting at a table talking to one of my teammates, one of my female teammates, and they were telling me about their boyfriends. And they were going on and on with their tales of woe about their boyfriends, and both of them, both times, both weeks, ended their stories by saying something to the effect of, "And so he's a real jerk, don't you think?" And both times I said, you know, maybe he's a jerk, but, you know, from his point of view, maybe from what you're telling me, the way it looks to him is such and such. And I don't even remember what I said, but it was something pretty obvious, you know, that occurred to me that maybe what he's thinking or worried about or trying to avoid or trying to achieve, something was pretty obvious. Both times they said, "Oh my God, I never thought of that." And so that's when it occurred to me that, yeah, maybe the male point of view is really not very well understood, maybe not very well articulated, maybe not very well represented. And so I said to my girlfriend at the time, who was also on the team, I said, "You know, I think I want to start a magazine or something." She said, "Well, you know, magazines are pretty expensive. Printing is expensive. Postage is expensive. Why don't you try a radio show?" I said, "Good idea. Electrons are cheap." So I did a radio show from 1983 to 1989 at a student-run station at Towson University north of Baltimore. The show had various names. I think we started out calling it The Lives of Men. Then it became In a Man's Shoes. And I even tried Men, Sex, and Power for a while. But it was mostly In a Man's Shoes. And it did pretty well. And it was a lot of fun, and I loved doing it. But after, from 1983 to 1989, I tried to get it onto some commercial stations, and I got some interest. But you know what? The sales staff at these commercial stations said, "We can't do this show. Nobody will buy ads on it." Nobody will buy ads on it. And their concern was that it would make women mad, or that the advertisers would be afraid it would make women mad. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so that was my first conscious memory, 1982, 83, when I started the radio show, that the softball thing. So that was my first conscious memory. But then after I got into men's issues pretty well, because, you know, I was talking about a different aspect of males every week with pretty interesting people, I remembered something that I used to hear as a kid. Now, you're very well aware of the harm it does to little girls when they hear, if they're good at math.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KCFR 90.1 FM. This is Ask Dr. Gail Show. Gail's Kimball
speaking.
What's
the message to her?
We're interviewing Jack Kammer about the men's movement and men's
roles. Girls aren't supposed to be good at math. Or, "You're really good at sports, ... for a girl." Well, you know, what's the message? You're not supposed to be good at sports. That's for boys. What I remembered hearing as a little boy was, "Wow, you're really good with babies, ... for a boy." And I didn't really have the equipment to think about what was going on there, but I remembered thinking, "What's up with that? What's going on here?" So that's as far back as I can go. And that's one of my earliest, that is my earliest memory of something going on with, you know, male gender stereotypes, biases, you know, that kind of thing. So there you go.
On your website, you say Jack Kammer, the counter feminist social worker. What does counter feminist mean?
Yeah. So let me mention that the counter-feminist social worker was how I was billing myself. And I guess to some extent I am billing myself that, because along with being a podcast host, I also am interested in maybe being a podcast guest. So I sort of made up this whole idea of a counter-feminist to distinguish what I think from anti-feminism. To me, an anti-feminist says, "No, It's all a bunch of baloney. It's a bunch of malarkey. Women have it easy. There's no problems with being a woman. It's just a bunch of junk. That's what an anti-feminist is. A counter-feminist listens to women talking about feminist perspectives and problems women have. A counter-feminist says, yes, and. Not yes, but yes, and. Let's talk about the rest of the story, the ways in which what's going on with men are connected to what's going on with women, and let's have, you know, let's talk about really solving these problems, because we're not going to solve the problems if we're not in balance or if we don't have a way of approaching balance. So that's a counter-feminist. Yes, and.
When I think of the men's movement that points out the hazards of being male, I think of Herb Goldberg and his book of that name, Warren Farrell, in terms of most well-known authors. What would you say are themes and what the men's movement points out are the hazards of being male? Men die earlier, commit suicide more, don't get proper health care. What are the hazards?
Well, the most influential book to me as I was undertaking this radio show, the most influential book to me was Herb Goldberg's The Hazards of Being Male.
Herb's dead now.
Now, Herb is, he's a PhD, a psychologist?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think his take was mostly psychological issues. I don't even remember him talking much about divorce or child custody. I don't think so. But and then the second most influential person to me was that I met our friend Fred Hayward. You know Fred, of course.
Yes.
And I just love Fred. He's brilliant. And, you know, I could say we hit it off really well, but probably more of the truth of it is that he was into this before I was, and I learned a lot from him. I mean, I got a lot of, he has some very interesting ways of saying things and seeing things. And I love Fred Hayward. So Herb Goldberg, Fred Hayward, you know, and Fred is not a divorced father's activist either, but to any great degree. I think what the three of us might have in common, Herb Goldberg, Fred, and me have in common, is just the idea of being able to live full, happy, and complete human lives. And for me, I can't speak for Herb and Fred, but for me, the primary goal for me is to make sure that boys and men have as many options for happiness and fulfillment, a fully human life, as women and girls do in this day and age, when we've done a lot of work to make sure that women and girls have full options. And I see some situations in which men and boys do not yet have that benefit.
Like what? What are specific issues that inhibit men's full lives?
A boy touches another boy, and he's got to say, no homo. Boys think about what they want to study in college. Well, petroleum engineering looks pretty lucrative. Right? And then, of course, there are the divorce issues. And there's the whole cultural problem, I think, of just in some ways, I'm not saying in all ways, but in some ways, along with being devalued, women are not overly valued, but are valued more than men are. Women's feelings are more likely to get empathetic responses than men's are. You know, you think about, a man, I think I should give credit to Tom Golden for this, because I think he's the one who first put this in my head. You know, imagine a woman sitting alone in a restaurant crying. You know, what's wrong with her? What happened? Should I go over and see if she's okay? Imagine a man sitting alone in a restaurant crying. It's not the same feeling. It's not the same So those are the kinds of things that I think are probably connected to the fact that we are still pretty primitive people, still a pretty primitive species, and it hasn't been that long since we were a species that had to do everything it could, had to wring every bit of efficiency and safety and survival probability out of what we could do. And we found that, well, women were maybe a little better at men than these at these things, and men were maybe a little bit better at women at these things, and in some cases a lot better at these things. And so we specialized. Women, you're going to do that, and men, you're going to do that, and that's going to give us the best chance of not being eaten alive by alligators and tigers, and best chance for our babies to survive.
So hunters and gatherers.
Yeah, but, you know, protectors and nurturers, you know. And so we had to do that. We had to specialize when we were primitive, when the world, you know, could easily put us into extinction. But we're not there anymore. Yet we still have these vestiges of, you know, I mean, suppose a little boy back on the Serengeti grasslands, a little boy was sitting around the campfire and it became his time to go out and, you know, take a spear and go be out on the perimeter to, you know, keep the lions away. You know, suppose he cried and said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I want to stay here at the campfire with my little brother and my little sister and my mom. And I don't want to go out there. What happens to him? What happened to him? Well, what happened to him was like a really strong dose, a really, really strong dose of what still happens to boys today who express any interest in the campfire stuff, you know, around the campfire and relationships and belonging and safety and comfort and expressiveness and, you know, warmth and affection and all those things that we all need, that you know, men, because of the primitive necessities, sort of had to forego, because they were out there, you know, maybe 12 of them, you know, covering, you know, a 3-acre campsite or a 1-acre campsite. You know, they're alone. They're all spread out. And that was required. And that's what became valued in men. And the men who were really valued weren't just the men who found that tolerable, but the men who really enjoyed that. They enjoyed the challenge of that. So that's how I see it. You know, we're still pretty primitive.
Right.
And you know, just as women have said, hey, over the past 50, 60, 70 years, hey, we don't want to be stuck here around the campfire, okay? There are a lot of men who are saying, hey, we really would like to get some access to that campfire, okay? And it hasn't gone for men back in as much as it has for women to be able to get out.
Just as that's a footnote.
That's the way it looks to me.
What I've read is that hunters and gatherers were pretty egalitarian. The men took care of the babies. The men, when they hunted as a group, the women would help with the nets and that kind of thing. So some people argue, I think like Marx, that agriculture and being settled down and having private property is what caused the sex roles to really divert and become separate.
Yeah, I've heard that agriculture was sort of a huge paradigm shift for us. Yeah, and so, but what did that change? I mean, the man was still the one who had the muscles. So in the interest of efficiency, he's going to be the one out there, you know, pulling the plow.
Yeah, but you know, in Africa, it's women who carry the burdens and do the heavy work, so.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I keep hearing what the women in Africa do. And I keep wondering, what do the men in Africa do? What do the men in Africa do? Why don't we talk about that? And I think it might be because they are down in the freaking diamond mines, which is just another form of being out on the perimeter, you know, taking care of external business. You know, Yeah. So, yeah, the women in Africa do a lot. I wish we'd talk more about the men in Africa.
Okay. Good point. What about in your own personal life? How has it evolved in terms of your parents' roles, your marriage? What kind of personal experience do you have with this double standard of male-female access to the good life?
Well, that's a good question, and there's lots of ways to answer it, but the one thing I definitely want to say that comes right to mind is that being in the men's movement and being exposed to different ideas about, you know, how you can be a man and get away with it, or insist on getting away with it, I learned probably the most important thing the men's movement has done for me is to just get me to the point where I could trust my feelings. Just trust your feelings. Not to think that you're always right, but also not to think that you're always wrong if you think you want some changes. Trusting your feelings has really helped me live a happier life. Because before I got to that point, whenever I was in a relationship with a woman and it wasn't going well, I was completely vulnerable to shaming. I was wrong. I'm somewhat right and somewhat wrong, and she's somewhat right and somewhat wrong, and we gotta, you know, work it out. So learning to trust my feelings got me to the point where I could say to a woman with whom I was in conflict, to say, look, you can't tell me how I should and shouldn't feel. I'm telling you how I feel. You're telling me how you feel. Don't tell me I'm wrong. Don't try to shame me. Don't try to shut me up. Don't try to turn it around and make it all about you. Because, you know, that technique is, well, you, what about me? You know, that's, and, you know, I don't go for that anymore. I don't take that bait. I say, yeah, I understand. You've got some skin in this game too, but so do I. Now, can we talk about it? And that has helped a lot. That's helped a lot. I guess that's, you know, the main thing for my own personal life that has been connected to being in the men's movement.
I'm working on a book about happy long-term marriages. And one of the questions I ask is, what have been your areas of conflict? So in your marriage, what have been the issues where you've had to work through this kind of feelings, communication, dialogue?
I don't want to get into specific issues because my wife isn't here signing a waiver saying I can talk about our stuff. But I will say that I think, you know, you might want to interview my wife. That might be interesting. I think my wife might say that one of the reasons we have a happy marriage, and I'm her third husband. She's had two previous husbands. I think one of the reasons we're having a happy marriage is because I know how to fight well.
Which means
fighting fair, not being afraid, not panicking, not saying stupid stuff because I'm panicked, not saying hurtful things because I'm hurt and angry. And this is not something I got from the men's movement, but, you know, one thing that I have found works for me in my relationships, and I've been doing it since before I met my wife, and we've only been married 7 years, going on 8. I didn't get married till I was 60. So what has helped me in my relationships when I'm in conflict with a woman is just to say, okay, I would like to have some ground rules. Number A, let's hold hands while we talk. let's hold hands while we talk. And I have found, at least I think I have found it, maybe I'm just imagining it, but I, what it seems like it does to hold hands with the person you're having some friction with is it just sort of discharges the negative energy, sort of like a lightning rod. Hmm. They can feel that, I mean them no harm. I'm not trying to hurt them. You know, this is my hand. Here, just hold my hand. And then the second rule that I have found works is, look, one of us, and I'm not sure who it's going to be first. We can take turns, flip a coin. Whoever is talking gets to talk until they have said everything they want to say. The other person has to just listen. And the rule is that just listening does not mean they believe a single freaking syllable of what you're saying. So there's no need for you to interrupt and jump in and cut the other person off and keep them from really saying what they want to say. No need for you to do that because they can say it and it doesn't mean you agree with a word of it. Then when they're done, you got their full picture. If you want, you can respond or you can return with your whole picture. And that has worked really well for me. And my wife and I, when we were new, we had a couple of those. We haven't had one in a long time. And I think my wife really appreciates that, you know, she can trust me. I'm fair. And when we have a disagreement, you know, it's easy for her to own her part of it. And it's easy for me to own my part of it. Because it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you got some stuff going on. So, there you go.
In the men's movement, it seems like your focus has been on men's access to their kids after divorce. What are you seeing in terms of any movement in terms of shared joint and physical custody? And tell us about the organizations that help men who are experiencing divorce.
Okay, well, it might seem that that's been one of my primary concerns. And it has been somewhat of a concern for me. I was the executive director of the National Congress, the National Congress for Men. And that was started as a generalist men's organization. And that's one of the interesting things about Fred and me. He sort of got mad at me when I was executive director. And NCM was in the middle of sort of an identity crisis about whether it was a generalist organization or a father's rights organization. And most of the people participating in NCM were divorced fathers. So I remember getting some advice from Warren Farrell, who said an organization is going to be what it wants to be. And it looks like NCM wants to be a father's organization, so that's probably the way you want to go. That sort of hurt Fred's feelings because he was in on the creation of NCM as a generalist organization. Anyhow. So, yes, I am very concerned about father's issues. But to me, fatherhood is the central issue for men, whether they're fathers or not. Very much like career opportunity is central for women, whether they want to be CEOs or not. It's just being recognized for having those skills, abilities, talents, and capabilities. You know, women can do math, they can make tough decisions, they, you know, all of those things that we doubted women could do as business people. Having those doubts be dispelled is good for women. It's good for women in a bazillion ways, not least of which is it's good for them about what they believe about themselves. Fatherhood is central for men because father's issues are based around the negative stereotypes of men, that men are cold, unkind, uncaring, selfish, mean, impatient, and all of that stuff, which in some people's minds justifies treating fathers badly.
And I would add deviant. There's a suspicion of men are with little kids, there's some weird sexual weirdness.
Yes. Yes, and even school teachers.
The KZRR supporters and by Happy Campers RV Rentals, a locally owned small business offering clean and comfortable RVs to rent for a weekend getaway or an extended vacation. This Happy Campers RV Rentals also offer a variety of camping essentials to meet your needs. Choose from different sizes and styles and feel at home away from home. For detail, visit happycamperschico.com. And Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by the Yoga Center of Chico, open every day with both in-studio and online classes via Zoom. And I've done both and really like them. It's a good place to support. In-studio classes following all state-mandated protocols for safety. The Yoga Center of Chico also has a retail store with some of my books at 250 Vallambrosia Avenue, Suite 150 next to T-Bar. Details are at yogacenterofchico.com or at 342-0100. That's 342-0100. So you're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM. We appreciate your donations. It's all volunteer for the most part at this station. And just want to let you know that I'm part of a free webinar on Saturday that starts at 8 a.m. that's about the new paradigm of consciousness as opposed to the old paradigm of materialism. And I have really interesting visionary scientists from my trilogy where I interviewed doctors and PhDs about what's real. And I was also interested in what gives them the courage to oppose the dominant paradigm. They get a lot of criticism and abuse. So if you're interested in that webinar, you can just email me and I'll send you the link. It's gkimble@csuchico.edu. So we're listening to Jack Kammer, and he is a leader in the men's movement and the author of three books.
Kentucky.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there was lots of resistance to shared parenting.
We're talking after divorce, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Not the 50-50 parenting kind of thing that you're talking about, where there's a one household and trying to be balanced in that household, but in shared parenting after divorce. There are two main constituencies that I see that are sort of standing in the way of shared parenting becoming more of the norm. One is divorce lawyers. And you know why, right? I mean, you can guess why.
They want money. It's from controversy.
Yeah. Exactly. 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 The more they can make divorce look like a kill or be killed enterprise, the more they can offer protection to their client against these horrible people over here who, by the way, did you know that I heard from your wife's lawyer that she's planning, you know, the more they can stir up paranoia and fear, they're a protection racket, right? I can protect you. I can keep you from being annihilated. You know, if the norm was, look, you're both going to be parents. Neither of you is going to be annihilated. You got some details to work out, but it can be done. And it's done successfully every day. Well, then what do we need a lawyer for? Then it becomes a matter of mediation. And in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sessions, done. And then maybe you need some tune-up sessions in a couple of years. Great. So divorce lawyers, I think, have been one of the main constituencies. And there was an effort a couple of years ago. It's the most recent effort I can think about. In one of the Dakotas, I'm not sure if it was north or south, but one of the main actors in defeating the bill there was the Bar Association. Who's the second constituency? All right, well, before I mention the second constituency, let me mention and assure you that I recognize the existence of the correlate of this constituency 50 years ago. 50 years ago, there were lots of men who had careers in the trades. And what made them men was that they were whatever, bricklayers, masons, plumbers. You know, my daddy taught me this, his daddy taught him this, and that's what we do. That's what makes me a man. Outside of the trades, you know, just the idea of making money is what makes me a man. That's my identity as a man. So, you know, it's a pretty strong impulse to have a personal identity. And so, 50, 60 years ago, when women came along and said, hey, Mr. Plumber, looks like you have pretty good business going there, and that's a nice trade you've got, and I see you've got a nice union helping you. And did I hear that you don't let women into that union? We need to talk about that. Well, how did men respond? We don't want no women in this union. This is for men, right? All right. So, look, I get that. Today, we still have a lot of women whose primary identity is as mother. I'm the mother. Yeah, he's the father, but I'm the mother. And to have some man say that he can be just as good a parent as you can be, it's kind of like, says who? No way. And there are a lot of women who sort of don't want to hear it. And they have trouble hearing it.
Is there an organization that represents these individual women?
I don't think there's an organization that is specifically and openly organized around this point that I'm going to mention. But there are many, many little organizations. And there is, you know, what some of us call an industry around the idea of male violence against women. And the other constituency that often shows up in general assemblies, state legislatures, when they're considering a joint custody bill, one of the main constituencies, along with the lawyers, is the domestic violence advocacy crowd, who are also making a lot of money. Some of those executive directors of those shelters, you know, pulling down $100K and more, $200K. But money isn't their primary motivation, at least not for the larger movement of women who are extremely concerned. I would say the facts do not comport with the level of concern. Who will tell state legislators, no, can't have forced joint custody, that's what they'll call it, forced joint custody, because it endangers women and children.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's what happens. So I think that we need, you know, the great quote from Gloria Steinem. I think she said it in 1995, and she's said it in an interview with feminist.com, a website, and then she also either said it or wrote it in Ms. Magazine. She said years ago, she said over the past, I think she said 25 years, over the past 25 years, we as women have done a good job of convincing the world that women can do what men can do. Our challenge over the next 25 years is to convince the world and ourselves, she said, parenthetically, to convince the world and ourselves that men can do what women can do.
Hmm.
And then she added, and so far, I don't think we believe it ourselves.
Hmm.
And it sort of makes sense, because for a man to be able to accept that, yeah, a woman can pick up a monkey wrench and, you know how to do what I have learned to do, is, you know, an easier pill to swallow than for a woman to accept that a man can be as deeply loving and nurturing and angelic. And I mean, women, many women believe they create, not just gestate, but create life, you know, like really mystically, like just some magical power that women have. When in fact, you know, what women do in gestation is a lot more, it's a lot more mundane than that. And it's really the zygote. It's the union of the sperm and the egg that sort of creates the life and takes care of business, sends out its own placenta, finds a place to attach to the uterus to draw sustenance. So, you know, for a woman to believe that her connection with life and the creation of life, and that's a pretty hard, that's a harder burden, a harder ask, I guess, would be the thing to say. It's a harder ask to ask women to sort of share that. And so it's understandable why there's resistance, but we got to overcome it if we're going to really have fairness and equality between the sexes. Because if men don't have fairness and equality at home, women aren't going to have fairness and equality in the workplace.
That's
because
right.
there are lots of men out there who are working not because that's where they want to be, but because that's where they got to be. And I remember as a little boy, right back along with that story of me hearing that I was really good with babies for a boy. I remember, this is sort of a recovered memory too, although I don't think I ever really forgot it. I remember thinking I could not imagine anything sadder than to be a man who has to leave his home every day, his wife and kids, and go out all day and be away from them and then come home tired. Now, my father was an old-time family doctor, so I saw this big time, big time. I mean, the hours that man put in were phenomenal. He was a family doctor, an old-time family doctor, made house calls until he was way past his prime. And I guess, you know, when he came home and was tired and grumpy, I just thought, wow, I don't want that. I do not want that. And when he died, we're at the funeral home, and all my brothers and sisters who were, you know, at the funeral home, and patients came, patient after patient came to pay their respects to old Dr. Kammer. And they would start telling stories about how warm and kind and caring and loving he was. And my brothers and sisters are looking at each other and saying, who are they talking about? Warm, kind, caring? My father gave at the office. And when he came home, he didn't have anything left. He was basically a stranger in his own house. And I did not want that.
Got it.
Did not want that.
How many siblings did you have?
Six.
So there are seven of you.
Yeah.
Wow. What was your birth order?
I'm number five.
Wow.
Number four son, number five kid.
Wow. In terms of other men's movements, in my video interview with Gordon Clay, he thought that recently kind of a strong voice is the mythopoetic that evolved from Robert Bly's work with men. What other organizations do you see are active doing the work besides the men's rights, father's rights groups?
Well, I have dabbled in every aspect of the men's movement I can touch. I wanted to know it all. I mean, when you're doing a radio show, you know, and you're looking for good guests, you know, you want to keep things interesting.
Outline the different branches.
Go ahead. Say it again.
Outline the different branches for us of the men's movement.
Well,
please.
I guess on one extreme you have the National Organization for Men Against Sexism,
NOMAS.
A very pro-feminist organization, NOMAS. On another extreme, you have, I don't know what you would call them, they're sort of, I guess you'd call them the anti-feminists. You don't want to hear anything about it. And, you know, they believe, I guess, you know, they can probably point to scripture that talks about, you know, how men are supposed to have dominion over women. Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, those are pretty, pretty big extremes.
Do they have a group? Is there a men's?
There's a 4chan about them, or, you know, a subreddit on Reddit. Yeah, you know, I mean, they're definitely out there. You know, there's also, well, so there's NOMAS, and then there's the very pro-feminist and very anti-feminist. I guess I would point to as the two extremes. The mythopoetic guys, and I did that. I did a sort of a cousin of that, which was the New Warriors Training Weekend. It was beneficial. It was fun. It was interesting. At the New Warriors, the thing I have to give the New Warriors credit for is that years and years after my father died, they helped me have my first cry about his death. So they can be pretty powerful in a lot of ways. But to me, you know, to talk about making things better for men and to not talk about all of these cultural and societal and political ways in which things could be made better for men is really kind of, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of wimping out. Because you'll often hear these fellas who are all about doing the work and getting in touch with their feelings and really owning their stuff and, you know, all of that stuff. And you say to them, well, you know, you really want to help men. That's what your organization is about, is helping men. How many men, have you ever wondered what percentage, have you ever measured, looked into what percentage of the men who come to your meetings and at check-in they say they're feeling lousy and terrible and depressed? How many of them are saying that because they're divorced and are having problems seeing their kids? Oh, well, maybe we should look into that. And maybe if you find out that they can't see their kids, and that's one of the reasons for a lot of the problems you're seeing, you know, alcoholism, depression, suicide attempts, not doing well at work, no successful relationships. Maybe one way to help men with all of those problems is to, you know, get right to the core of the problem. What if, you know, a couple hundred of you guys went to take California, Sacramento, for instance, and walked around the halls of the state legislature and say, hey, guys, speaking to the legislators, we know you don't hear this a lot, but you really need to do something about joint custody. And a lot of problems are caused by the fact that a lot of men are bereft of their children. So we need to do something about that.
Got it. And I want to get to your books before we run out of time.
I have been going on, haven't I?
It's wonderful. You've written Goodwill Towards Men, your first book, Women Talk Candidly About the Balance of Power Between the Sexes. And then the second book, If Men Have All the Power, How Come Women Make the Rules? And third one for young men, Heroes of the Blue Sky Rebellion, How You and Other Young Men Can Claim All the Happiness in the World. I know that you feel like there's been kind of a lace curtain, I think you call it, in terms of getting the word out about your books. Explain what that is.
Well, it's not just about my books. I mean, it's not that the lace curtain is only, you know, out to get me. Nicholas Davidson wrote a really wonderful...
So you're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM. We're just finishing up with Ask Dr. Gail Kimball here. I really encourage you to email me and let me know topics of interest to you, gkimball@csuchico.edu. And next month, in June, the second Thursday of the month at 6, we're having a Maidu elder talk about their experiences, their successes with the environment. And now, stay tuned with Sandra for peanut butter and jelly time.